Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Last month, the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs, retired General Eric Shinseki, made a staggering announcement at a mental health conference. He said that more veterans have committed suicide since 2001 than have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. More than 1.8 million American men and women have served in those wars. On this Veterans Day, a look at some of the ways people across the country are trying to combat record-high unemployment, increasing substance abuse, domestic violence, failed marriages, homelessness, and suicide among Americans' veterans. Joining me in the studio are Leo Shane of Stars and Stripes. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And retired U.S. Army Captain Scott Quilty of Survivor Corps. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan.
First, though, we're going to talk for a few minutes by phone with the leaders of several groups that help veterans, going first to Brad White in Burbank, California. He's chair and founder of Yellow Ribbon America. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
How you doing, Diane?
Right. Actually, it's Susan Page. I'm sitting in for Diane.
Oh, hi, Susan. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Diane's on a cruise with public radio listeners. So tell us, Brad White, you were a veteran of Desert Storm. How did that lead you to found this organization, Yellow Ribbon America?
Well, actually, I'm a veteran of the Desert Storm era. I was actually in basic training during Desert Storm, and it lasted 100 days. So by the time I was done through infantry school, it was over. But what happened was is that when I was going through basic training, my mother had a yellow ribbon tied around the tree, and she's a single parent, and she's a cancer survivor, and basically had a major plumbing issue, and the neighbors came together and took care of the bill, and by the time I found out about it, I didn't have to be concerned about it, and I never forgot that. And, you know, as the years passed and when these wars began, you know, I realized that the best help comes from home, and if somebody could take care of, you know, a loved one of somebody in the military so they don't have to be concerned with them, then basically they can focus on their mission and come home safe. But most importantly, the community is now tied not only to that family but to their local military member, regardless of branch or service.
So what kinds of things does your organization try to do?
Well, actually, we've been partnered with our state capitol, and we are a campaign that has not only, you know, done a lot of great things in California, but we've kind of built the blueprint to be able to help local communities support their local military, whether it's emergency funds, whether it's, you know, sponsoring welcome home events or Christmas parties, or, you know, helping to facilitate supporting troops overseas and doing things for them when they come home injured. It's tying that community to their local military so nobody falls between the cracks, because we don't want it to be like it was when the troops came back from overseas from Vietnam. Nobody was there for them and nobody was there for their families. And I think what's different right now is that basically Americans know that regardless of your politics, you need to support your troops, and especially you need to support their families, because they give them, you know, to America and give up birthdays and holidays and all kinds of events and times in their lives that they can never have again. And they don't mind doing it, but at the same time, it does add a lot of stress.
And we're just now as a country pulling out of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Has the recession affected what your group, Yellow Ribbon America, has been able to do?
Well, you know, when we started this with the National Guard Association in California, it was just a local effort, and I guess in our ignorance, because we're not nonprofit people by nature, you know, we kind of built a model that basically the community started realizing, hey, this is an extra reason for me to participate. And last year, we were kind of concerned. We do a very large Christmas drive, not only in California, but, you know, in other states. And actually, donations increased, and I'm speaking specifically in-kind donations. But we had a lot of people that said, you know, our kids have enough toys. Let's donate something for these military children. Hey, what can I do? And so, you know, yeah, definitely the economy, I can see, has made a difference. But when we roll out and do direct representation with local military units and equipment, people, there's no shortage of people stepping up. And, you know, that to me, I'm not used to. You know what I mean? I guess I have like that perception that, oh my God, you know, I got to take care of my family or whatever. But, you know, I find myself wanting to give and help more. So I don't really see it as much.
All right. Good to hear. Brad White, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
He's the chairman and founder of Yellow Ribbon America, where we're talking about some of the services available now for veterans who are returning back home. Scott, tell us about your own experience as a returning veteran.
Sure, Susan. I was injured in Iraq in 2006. I was moving into a village, leading a patrol in an area that I'd never been into before, and I stepped on an improvised explosive device. I woke up a week later here in Washington, D.C.
And what injuries did you sustain?
I lost an arm and a leg in that explosion, and it took about 18 months of recovery right down the street at Walter Reed to get back on my feet. That turned out not to be the hardest part of that experience, though.
What turned out to be the hardest part?
The hardest part for me was really rejoining my family, my community, was really making that transition and making a healthy homecoming. That was the toughest part.
And you have now joined Survivor Corps. What does it do?
Survivor Corps is it's a global network of military and civilian survivors of war that are helping each other to overcome the effects. We're launching an initiative today, along with dozens of other leading organizations, called the Campaign for Healthy Homecoming. What the campaign is doing is writing a plan, a national plan, for healthy homecoming. On the president's desk right now is a plan to win the war in Afghanistan. What we don't have as a country is a plan to win the war at home, the war that Brad just referenced, that the healthy homecoming for service members, for veterans and their families.
I think a lot of Americans would be shocked to hear you say that losing an arm and a leg was not the hardest part of coming home. What did you need, or what was lacking in terms of what was available to you that made that such a difficult transition?
Transition is such a, and homecoming is such a diverse topic. It includes so many different, it's getting a job, it's going back to school, it's reconnecting with your church, it's connecting for the first time with a community or reconnecting with that community. It's getting to know your spouse and kids again. There's so many different facets. There are lots of great programs out there, and there really isn't a program that spans the whole spectrum of it. That's what makes it, I think, so difficult.
And what kind of job do you feel the Veterans Administration has been doing in terms of, and the Department of Defense, in terms of helping this integration back in communities for our veterans?
I think they've made some great strides. And since I came through with my experience, they're streamlining processes and they're trying to get the paperwork problems that we remember from some of the media reports. I think they're doing a better job than they have in the past. And they're part of the campaign that I referenced. So they're part of the solution as well.
Leo Shane, you're a reporter for Stars and Stripes. Now, some people may not understand exactly the nature of Stars and Stripes. Tell us about, is it a government publication or a private one?
Sure. We're the newspaper that most troops downrange in Iraq and Afghanistan read. We deliver issues there every day. We are affiliated with the Army, but we're editorial independent. So we do get to take a critical look at some of the issues that you're referencing here, some of the successes and failings in the VA and the DOD.
And how long is the history of Stars and Stripes?
We date back to World War II continuously. We did the paper was founded during the Civil War, a couple of Union soldiers putting together a handful of issues then. But we've been continuous in Europe and Pacific since World War II.
Well, I know that's a real service for a lot of people serving abroad. So tell us, how do you think the government, the administration is doing, the Pentagon, the Veterans Administration, in terms of helping soldiers who are coming home?
There is a new emphasis with the Obama administration on especially veterans services. It's something that the Bush administration was very focused on the wars and military benefits. We've seen a big shift that frankly a lot of the veteran service organizations have appreciated in looking at veterans benefits, looking at issues like homelessness among returning veterans, unemployment, things of that nature. It's still a very large bureaucracy, and the VSOs, your Veterans of Foreign War, your other groups, still have plenty of work to do to help out these vets in decoding how to get them through the system.
You know, General Shinseki, the retired Army general who now heads the Department of Veterans Affairs, gave a speech on October 26th to a mental health summit. And in the speech, he said, more veterans have committed suicide since 2001 than we have lost on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. That just shocks me. How is that possible?
And I was at that speech, and there was a bit of a gasp that went up in the crowd when that happened. You know, the issue of suicide is one that the DOD and VA are both struggling with, very much trying to figure out how to get the best mental health services, how to find those specialists and get them to. There's still the issue of stigma among both soldiers and veterans. You know, nobody wants to be the guy who needs to talk about his feelings. Nobody wants to be the guy who, you know, lets down his buddies because he's not there on the battlefield. And General Shinseki, now Secretary Shinseki, and many of the top leaders at the DOD have put a new emphasis on that. It will still take years to get rid of that stigma, but we're seeing more and more high-ranking guys saying, look, if you're suffering, we need to know because we can't have you commit suicide.
We're talking during this hour with the leaders of several groups that, independent of the government, that are trying to help returning vets. How much difference has that made?
I think it's made a pretty significant difference. You know, we hear from soldiers and veterans all the time, trying to figure out, you know, what their GI Bill benefits are and what health benefits they might be eligible for, things of that sort. The VA has been trying to improve its outreach. VA budget is going to be increasing next year, and a large portion of that is going to be better communications. But for many of these vets, it's still many phone calls getting lost in the system and calling up some of the new organizations, calling up some people who know what you've been through is a valuable service to them.
We're talking with Leo Shane. He's a reporter for Stars and Stripes. And with Scott Quilty, he's a U.S. Army captain and U.S. program manager for a group called Survivor Corps. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. We'll go to the phone shortly. Give us a call and stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're now joined by phone by Tom Iceland. He's executive director of Sun Valley Adaptive Sports. Tom, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Well, thank you, Susan. Good morning.
Now, tell us what kind of services you are providing for veterans.
Well, we use sports and recreation as a method of healing and therapy for young men and women who have been severely wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the things I would like to say is, you know, the government's been doing a pretty good job as it relates to work, school, family, health, and community. But if you think about it, if you don't feel good about yourself, how can you feel good about going to work or school or dealing with family? And if you become, you know, kind of a, and I'd say in the nicest way, like a deadbeat dad because, you know, you're so depressed, you have some anger and stress, and you can't really function, then it becomes generational because what's going to happen to the children? So we use sports and recreation all throughout the year, different winter sports, summer sports, and try to give them a sense of hope and then use that in a way where they can apply those skills to work, school, and family. And we follow up with them for 3 years after they've attended one of our events.
Now, you talk about adaptive sports. What kind of adaptations can you make for veterans who may come back from the war with various disabilities?
Wow. Well, that's a big question because, you know, you think there's almost 150 sports out there, and no matter what the injury, whether it's a physical injury or a cognitive injury such as traumatic brain or PTSD, there's a number of different devices, or just sometimes it's the method of the way you teach something. As you've probably seen, you know, when you take skiing, for example, if you have an amputation, leg, you can use a snowboard with a special adaptive device, or you could, if you're, let's say, a double leg amputee, you could sit down in something called a monoski or a bi-ski, something you can sit in. There's special water ski pieces of equipment for physical injuries, but also a lot of it with cognitive injuries is balance. And so there's special, let's say, booms that go on ski boats to help people learn how to ski. And once they can help redefine some of those motor skills, they are able to do sports. And so basically just about any sport has adaptive equipment for just about any injury.
Now, how do you go about getting funded for this project?
Well, we're all funded by private family foundations and the public. We receive no state or federal funding, but that's one of the things I've been advocating now. I've just started to work with some senators to try to raise $1 billion, actually, of the $600 billion the government's hoping to appropriate over the next 50 years for sports and recreation. That'll be distributed through the VA system as well as some private organizations.
All right. And if veterans want to find out about your program or other programs that offer them opportunities with sports, where do you suggest they go?
Oh, they can go to sunvalleyadaptivesports.org. So it's SVASP.org. That's SVASP.org.
All right. Well, thank you very much for giving us a call. Tom Eislin.
Thank you very much.
Executive Director of Sun Valley Adaptive Sports. We've actually put up links to all the organizations we're talking to during this hour on our website on drshow.org. So that's another place you can go for some of that information. How much difference do you think it makes, Scott, to have things that are not just totally related to, say, getting a job, something like a sports program?
I think it's absolutely essential. I'm very familiar with Tom's program and Sun Valley Adaptive Sports. It's an excellent program. I was injured in October of 2006, and it was February 2007 that I was on a snowboard in Vail, and my men in Iraq were able to see a photo of me going down a hill. I remember the last time they saw me, I was on my back, you know, fighting for my life. Sports and recreation, I think, play just a tremendous role in the recovery process.
So what did it mean to you personally?
To me personally, it meant getting out of the hospital bed, right? It meant getting out of that hospital environment, which can just be debilitating in and of itself. And it also was a chance to connect with the people around me, the people that had been there with me. I mean, that peer support, that what happens on the slope right there is also a healing process, not just the sport itself.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join our conversation. We'll go first to Roger. He's calling us from Rolla, Missouri. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I did. There's a couple comments. And first of all, props to General Shinseki. He's a great guy. I'm a big fan of his. I was in Afghanistan in 04 and 05. And I've been listening to the show a little bit about, you know, getting back into civilian life and stuff like that. I think the biggest problem was that when you come out of the Army, I was a staff sergeant. I mean, you have a tremendous amount of responsibility, and you're a veteran, and there's yellow ribbons everywhere, and everybody's really supportive in that sense. But when you come back into the economy and into the society, essentially what you find is while you spent 8 years, in my case 8 years in the Army, you didn't go to college and you didn't work in corporate America. There are no jobs. And you can't really get better in this society, in this economy, when you don't have an opportunity. And that was probably essentially what happened to me. Was I was a nurse in the Army, an LPN. I had a valid nursing license. I went to a local hospital. They loved my resume. When I tried to get a job, they said, well, you need this particular certification. I tried to get the certification, and I was effectively shut out from every school in the region because the certification class was only for their students. Did they do it because I was a veteran? Maybe. Well, obviously not, but neither would they let me in. And so essentially I ended up working in a cabinet shop at like $8 an hour with a bunch of crackheads. And so how, and this is not, I've talked to a lot of friends, and this is not an uncommon result.
And Roger, so you've been able even to this day to get your certification for the LPN?
Oh no. Essentially what happened, it was like $1,500, and I had to stay in another city. So to earn $14 an hour, I was going to have to spend almost $1,000. And I was a nurse and a combat medic and had given thousands of IVs, and anybody who's in the Army will tell you combat medics give IVs. They do it in the dark. But, I mean, what the general point is that when you get out of the Army, if you're enlisted, which most of the people are, even if you're an officer, and what you find is that there's support from the VA, and they've done a great job, no doubt about it. The VA does a great job. I love them to death. Wouldn't be working if it wasn't for them. But in the current situation with the public, there's a scarcity of jobs as it is. And then when you go to get one, what you find is you're barely surviving and paying rent.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a problem like PTSD, okay, and then you look around at your surroundings and you're in some low-income apartment with a broken-down car making $9 to $10 an hour, when a month ago you had full benefits and salaries, and what you get is thanks for working for me, veteran, but what it ends up at the end of the month is what? No money. You can't pay your rent, and you're struggling to get benefits. And if you do, so there's a serious disconnect in what the intent is, in all the yellow ribbons and all of that, to the reality on the ground.
Yeah, Roger, I'm really distressed to hear about your experiences. Leo Shane.
Yeah, the unemployment among returning veterans is an issue that, I don't know, it's gotten a lot of press. We've been following it. Unemployment nationally is just over 10% now, but back in September, it turned out, we got the numbers that there were more than 185,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans without a job. That's more than we've got over in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. So the VA has really been looking at the GI Bill as the answer to that, paying for troops who come back to go to school for 4 years with minimal costs. There's been some snags with that, but also they're seeing now there's more and more folks in Roger's situation who would rather have certification or some sort of vocational training, things of that sort. So I know there's several people on Capitol Hill looking at ways to adapt the GI Bill going ahead for folks who maybe aren't thinking a four-year degree, maybe are thinking, I'd like to continue in the medical field and I need these certifications.
So is there anything Roger could do now to help himself with his immediate situation?
You know, I don't know all the specifics there, Roger, but I'm sure, I know there are various job training programs now. In terms of medical professions, I'm not sure, you know, what you're looking at, what exactly is available in your area. Lots of groups like AMVETS, like IAVA, that's the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, are talking more about job training programs and ways they can reach out to them. So it might be worth contacting some of those VSOs.
All right, Roger, thanks for your service. And thank you for giving us a call and telling us about your experiences on the Diane Rehm Show. Now, Scott, I know that Survivor Corps is working in Massachusetts for veteran peer support program. Tell us about that.
Sure. In partnership with State Veteran Services in Massachusetts, we've set up a peer outreach and support program. So it's training veterans to go out and seek out veterans that are struggling to make that healthy homecoming. Reached 7,000 veterans in the last year.
And what can a peer do that maybe somebody else would not be able to do?
A peer, Susan, has been there, has experienced what you have. And what Leo was referencing was stigma, some of the stigma associated with mental health conditions or in the experience of war. Peers break down that stigma to a fundamental level because there is no stigma talking to someone that's been there.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to talk for a few minutes now on the phone with Tori Lyon, who is executive director of the Jericho Project, which is working to end veterans' homelessness. Thank you for joining us on The Diane Rehm Show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about the Jericho Project. What is it?
Jericho Project is a supportive housing nonprofit organization. We're based in New York City. We have been around for more than 26 years, And about 2 years ago, we started a veterans initiative to build and develop supportive housing for homeless and low-income veterans. We have a focus on serving veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who are having difficulties transitioning back to civilian life and who may be at risk of homelessness.
And when you think about the homeless population, how many of the people who are homeless are veterans?
Well, it's really kind of a national disgrace. A 2007 study showed that 1 in 4 homeless adults in the country is a veteran, whereas only about 11% of the general population is. So veterans are overrepresented in the homeless population.
Well, that's pretty. 1 out of 4 veterans, when you look at the homeless population. Why is that number so large?
There's lots of different reasons why that may be the case. About half of the homeless veterans are from the Vietnam era, and when those soldiers came back from the war, there weren't a lot of services in place. Many of them developed substance abuse or mental health issues, sometimes from their combat, sometimes not from combat, but they really fell through the cracks, and that's a big portion of the homeless population.
What do you see with the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan?
It's actually a little alarming. Here in New York City, we were seeing more families who are where one of the parents has been in Iraq or Afghanistan. We have one family that we're going to be housing who the father is an Iraq war vet, and he has 4 children and a wife, and he was just discharged in January of this year and ended up with his family in the homeless shelter by September. So it seems that the multiple deployments, the combat stress that these soldiers are coming back with is causing a fairly rapid cascade of economic problems, mental health problems, and even homelessness.
That's a pretty shocking situation. I know that that you had a big groundbreaking yesterday. Tell us about that.
Yes, we did. We were really pleased yesterday to break ground on our second veterans residence. It's in the Bronx, just adjacent to the Bronx VA Medical Center, and we have a very strong partnership with them. It will be home to 76 homeless and low-income veterans when it's completed in 2011. And that is it's a really unique project. We're using funds from New York City, New York State, from the federal government, and from many private sources. So it's a real public-private partnership that's working to solve and end veterans' homelessness. And we think that's going to be the way to do it, with everybody working together.
Well, it's great to have private projects and projects that have a private component like yours. But do you think the federal government ought to be doing more to try to house homeless vets, and also maybe to prevent some veterans from becoming homeless?
I do think the federal government can always do more. I don't think that we should always look to the federal government and the VA to do everything, because I do think it's the soldiers are over there defending our country, and I think it's really everybody's responsibility. The good news is that the VA really is doing more. Last week in Washington, D.C., there was a VA homeless summit to end veterans' homelessness in 5 years, and they are backing that up with some new funding, new homelessness prevention, which is very important. Sometimes a veteran may become homeless because they're just a month behind on rent, and sometimes just a small cash grant will prevent them from becoming homeless. So the VA is looking at prevention. They're looking at doing more housing, and slowly, we hope to chip away at the problem.
All right, Tori Lyon, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
She is executive director of the Jericho Project. She joined us by phone from New York. And again, all of these groups, you can find links to them, to their sites on our website, drshow.org. This problem of homelessness with American vets, Leo, tell us about it.
As Tori just said, the VA came out last week with a 5-year plan to end homelessness among veterans. Estimates right now are about 130,000 veterans are sleeping on the street at some point during the year. And if unchecked, I believe Secretary Shinseki said last week, that number could grow as much as 10 to 15% over the next 5 years. So they're going to be committing about $3.2 billion over the next few years into the program. The interesting part to me with that is, along with some more preventative services, some more housing services, as we just heard, they're going to be linking up with more private groups like Tories. because of, as they said, groups that they haven't necessarily worked enough with in the past, groups that they see a lot of value in, but reaching out beyond just the VA department.
Scott, why do you think some returning veterans are at risk for becoming homeless?
I think there are a lot of factors that go into the homelessness problem, but some of the principal ones are, you know, this is 8 years of war, multiple deployments, and we just don't have a plan for this healthy homecoming as troops return from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
All right. Scott Quilty is a retired U.S. Army captain, and he's program manager for Survivor Corps. Also with me in the studio is Leo Shane, a Washington Bureau reporter for Stars and Stripes. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones. You can call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, tennis star Andre Agassi.
When I was a little kid, I used to tell myself to run off the court and not do this, and yet I would continue, and yet I would continue. And I felt this contradiction between what I want to do and what it is I choose to do. It feels like the core of my life.
Agassi's new autobiography is called Open. Join us.
Let's go to the phones. We'll talk to Claire. She's calling us from Hannington, New Jersey. Claire, thanks for joining us.
Yes, hi, and thank you for doing this program today. While I was waiting on the phone, I just happened to look up the word hero. It prefaces what I'm about to say in the dictionary, and it says to watch over, protect a man of great strength and courage. I lost my brother, Buddy, after he came back from the war, and he took his life. And I used to say how he died. Now I no longer do. And I guess what I have to say today is when I was in several grief support meetings and people went around, and as they were thanking those that lost their loved ones as a result of the war, and they were sharing their grief, and when I shared mine, this has now happened three times, I was asked to leave. It was like my brother was almost disgraced, and I learned then to somewhat isolate, you know. And he came back from Iraq and sunk into, I guess, a dark despair, really, really deep. And, you know, the stigma and took his own life. And I think what I'd like to say is today is that to help, it feels like I have an invisible tattoo on my heart, like a scarlet letter S, you know. And it is today suicide where AIDS was 30 years ago, and it was shush, shush, you know, in the closet. Now, I know you had a fact on earlier about how many died, and this just breaks my heart. And for every person that dies by suicide, you know, 10 others are gravely affected. I'm not lessening any loss. And I wish that those that have lost a loved one by suicide in any way, if they began to talk about it, like Anderson Cooper lost a brother, you know, Sully, the pilot on the Hudson, he lost his dad. You know, Tony Dungy, the Super Bowl coach, he lost the son. Danielle Steele, it goes on and on. And if those folks or others would just come out and talk about it and say, I have struggled with this loss, and I survived, and I'm here, and got it out there, the word suicide, which is an ugly word, and instead of it being in the closet where it is, and coming back in so much pain, you know, seeing his buddies wounded and died, you know, how can any human being, you know, handle it? In his case, you know, he could not get a mental health treatment that he needed, but I'm not blaming that on anything. I'm just saying if the word was out there, you know, maybe he wouldn't. I can't turn back the clocks of time, but it is a lonely grief because to be told by anybody he's not a hero. When I began the call with, you know, a man of great strength and courage, or a woman of great strength and courage. And so I feel his loss today, which was, this is the day, 3 years ago, ironically, Veterans Day. And so I just ask the public or any to get, please speak about it, and perhaps, you know, it'll eventually become that not every 18 minutes someone dies. It was 26 minutes before the war began. Now it's every 18 minutes. So it's, anyway, thank you for letting me share, and I really am grateful for the show today, and thank you so much.
All right, Claire, thank you very much for your call, and our thanks to your brother for his service. Leo.
Yeah, part of the issue of combating the stigma, and something that both the Defense Department and Department of Veteran Affairs are dealing with, is not just encouraging folks to seek help if they need it, but also trying to educate troops about signs of why they might need help. You know, if someone's suffering from depression or someone comes back irritable, they're having trouble readjusting, they might not recognize that as a precursor to post-traumatic stress disorder or, you know, suicidal tendencies. There's also more focus on family programs, you know, spouses who see that their husband has come back changed. So there's more of an emphasis on that, but still quite a ways to go.
Scott, is there still a stigma about suicide, do you think, among returning veterans?
I think absolutely. Claire, your friend was a hero by any definition, I think. The definition that we use most commonly in the service is regular people in extraordinary circumstances, and it's very clear that he was in some extraordinary circumstances. It illustrates that he's still a casualty of war. And there's a great organization that's part of the Campaign for Healthy Homecoming called TAPS, and I'd urge her to contact them. That's exactly what they do. They work with the survivors that are left after something like that, whether they were injured in war or whether they were injured when they came home.
All right, Claire, thanks again for giving us a call. Let's go to Stephen. He's calling us from Batavia, Illinois. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call. I want to say to Claire, the last caller, you know, amen, sister. I'm the coordinator of volunteers at a suicide prevention center about 45 miles outside of Chicago. And, you know, I hate to say it, but it's been kind of hard for me to listen to the first, you know, at the top of the hour you said, you know, more soldiers have died from suicide than from other things. And then it felt to me like for 35 minutes we were talking around suicide instead of talking about suicide. And, you know, in my experience, suicide is the issue. And so I hope that we wouldn't talk around it. And so I'm glad that we're talking about it now. So thank you. I really appreciate that. And now I'm in a tough spot because being in this field, I've been living and breathing suicide prevention for 3 years. I feel like I have so much important information that has to get out there. I would hope that you do have a show at some point in the future focusing on suicide prevention, not only for veterans, but in the wider community.
Well, Steve, yeah, let me ask you, since you work in the field of suicide prevention, tell us, are there any special approaches or challenges when it comes to dealing with veterans who might be considering suicide?
Yeah, and a lot of it is that stigma. You know, there is, and it's true in law enforcement also. It's true in a lot of different fields that, you know, it's not okay to not be okay. You know, you have to be strong. You have to be independent. You have to be able to take care of other people. And so, you know, it's not okay to have people take care of you. You know, that's something that we bump up against. And a big part of it is the stigma that Claire talked about. You know, a good friend of mine was in the service for 6 years. He was a soldier. And, you know, he got out in 07. And when he got back, he told me, you know, there was a time that he was on base in Germany. And, you know, when his unit got information, and it wasn't just his unit, but his other units, when they got information that they would be redeployed for, I don't know, second or third tour, within 2 weeks, you know, 8 soldiers on that base had died from suicide, is what he said. And I imagine that every single one of those families, you know, felt like they had to isolate and felt like they couldn't speak out, you know, and felt like they couldn't engage on this issue. Because it is a hard word to say. You know, suicide is a hard word to say, and it's even harder to say that, you know, my son, my brother, whoever in the service, you know, died from suicide. And, you know, notice I say died from suicide as opposed to committed suicide, because that's what makes more sense to me. But, I mean, the numbers are astounding. And so, you know, we need to get comfortable with that word, or we're going to keep losing people.
All right, Stephen, thank you so much for your call. Any comments from our panel?
No, I think what Steve is seeing is what lots of programs are seeing around the country. And I think showing that seeking help is coming from a position of strength is an initiative that the Department of Defense is engaged with now and working to get that at the lowest level. I'm coming from an infantry unit. I know exactly what he's talking about with stigma issues. It's sometimes not okay to seek help. Changing that and changing the course of that debate is going to take some time, but it's a vital issue. It's an issue for all of us to deal with.
Bob has sent us an email. Bob writes, as a military member, all your problems are shared and your decisions may be life or death, but few, if any, of them leave you alone and in a bind. I can remember the great fear of dealing with paying bills, unemployment, uncooperative spouses, etc., that you must face alone. He says, when you're in a unit, you have a simple philosophy and interdependency with your unit. Then your unit is jerked away from you. In my opinion, this is the actual cause of PTSD in most cases. What do you think about Bob's point, Scott?
I think Bob's point is an excellent one, and I would say we do have a tight-knit unit. I had a platoon and a squad and went through some of the toughest times in war and some of the toughest times coming home. When we get out of the service, we find our new units, right? My new squad is my pastor at church. It's my wife, right? It's my family. Like, we have to find, as veterans, those new squads and new platoons to share that experience with so that we can overcome it together.
Let's go to Derek. He's calling us from Newport, Kentucky. Derek, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to address the point that if people are really concerned for the welfare of veterans, that critical thought needs to go into the root causes of war. You know, in my opinion, it seems that the war in Iraq was more based on empirical whim and corporate profit as opposed to spreading freedom and justice. I think it's more about control of resources. And in that, I think that the American people are being fed a lie about the necessity of war as, you know, the smiting of evil or something like that. And I just would like to say, why don't people think more critically about why we're at war and what these people are dying for, instead of just trying to patch up the after effects when they get back home from these horrible situations that, in reality, don't have to exist if we would just examine our values and what we are really trying to achieve in this world.
All right, Derek, thanks for your call. Scott?
I think one of Derek's points in having been there on the ground, too, war is just one of the most debasing experiences that I've experienced when you're standing and shooting at another person back and forth, never not really knowing who they are, who they really are, who we all are in that situation. But soldiers can't pick their wars. We just fight them. And supporting soldiers and veterans and families when they're through with that experience is definitely a national priority.
I wonder, Leo, is when the Iraq war became very controversial, the Afghanistan war, a lot of debate about that as mm-hmm. President Obama considers whether to send more troops. To what degree does that affect soldiers on the ground there?
I got a chance to spend a month in Iraq just last year, just about this time last year, in Afghanistan 2 years before that. And, as someone who doesn't have a military background, it always surprises me how much it is how much soldiers can just make it a job. It's, you're sent over there, you've got a job to do, you don't deal with the political side and you deal with that. So, there are plenty of guys who have their opinions and, obviously are going through this emotional time, but that's, as you just said, that's, you don't get to pick your wars, you're assigned to them. I think part of the struggle is, it is something that no one else has gone through. This isn't like during Vietnam. This isn't like during World War II, where there were people on your block who you knew who had gone to war. The military is a very small military compared to what it was in the past. And when you return, when you're talking to your spouse, when you're talking to your pastor, when you're talking to someone at the grocery store, they don't understand what that was like. They don't understand the experiences you've gone through. And it heightens that disconnect for a lot of guys.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I do think one difference from the Vietnam era is Americans generally are not blaming soldiers for, even if they feel very much against the war. I mean, I think that is a division Americans have made in supporting soldiers, even if you oppose the war. Do you think that's right, Scott? Is there a difference now from the Vietnam era?
I'm a little young for being around them, but that's okay. From my experience with this, communities really want to do something. They're looking for that thing. They're looking for all the local programs that you've had on the show today. They're looking for that way to connect, and we need to do that as Americans, look for a way to connect and to support veterans on this day and every day.
Let's go to Michelle calling us from Oklahoma City. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. Good morning. Happy Veterans Day.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the opportunity. I am a psychologist here at the Medical School and Health Science Center. I've dedicated my career to supporting families affected by trauma and deployment. I just thought that listeners might like to know about some free resources I've created that are all available on the Internet. If you just Google them, one of them is called the SAFE Program. One of them is called Operation Enduring Families, and they're being used by state and federal agencies across the country. It's all helping families understand. And then in my personal life, I've written books for teenagers whose parents have experienced trauma. And one of them just came out last week called My Story, Blogs by Four Military Teens. And my mom, who's a teacher, and I have created these with really a ministry to support these teens. And you can read all about them at our website, seedsofhopebooks.com. And we hope and pray they are a blessing to military and veteran families all across the country.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for letting us know that. What are the special challenges you think teens face when their parents are deployed?
The research is finding that, just being a military kid in general can be a challenge because your parents move, your family moves 6 to 9 times, much less now with them being deployed to a dangerous, often war zone, often repeated times. We're finding these children are experiencing increased anxiety, some insomnia, okay, sleep problems. We're actually even seeing differences in things like blood pressure and heart rate. So there's some real physiological differences. I'd want to note that most teens really do well, and so most children are resilient, but I think it's incumbent upon us as citizens to be aware of these challenges, to reach out and identify. Some schools don't even know that the kids are military. And so first is awareness and then providing programming if and as needed to support these young people who are also serving our country.
All right, Michelle, they certainly are. Thank you very much for your call. Leo.
As I said, the military has been putting more of an emphasis on military families, especially President Obama and the First Lady have been putting more of an emphasis on military families. But one of the resources that I've come across in my reporting that You know, the DOD can do so much. They can try and reach different folks. But a couple of years ago, the Sesame Street folks, Sesame Workshop, put together a deployment video for the youngest children who, you know, it's tough to reach 3 to 5 year olds. So that's another resource out there from a private group.
That's great to hear. Leo Shane and Scott Quilty, thank you both so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.